This series ends where it began, with a woman of questionable heritage identified as the Dark Lady of Shakespeare's sonnets. I started with Lucy Bainham, a woman also nicknamed Black Luce, who some historians believe was a black African, Shakespeare's muse and his lover. My final other Tudor has also been identified as a candidate for the sonnet's dark-skinned, black-haired lover. She's called Amelia Lanyer. I'm Jerry Broughton, and this is We Are the Tudors, listening for the voices of those whose lives have been silenced or lost to history. Amelia Lanyer is probably the most well-known of all the other Tudors. Sadly, she's mainly known as Shakespeare's Dark Lady, for which, by the way, there is absolutely no serious evidence. The reality of her life and work is far more interesting. She's both an insider and an outsider. She was born in London and baptised a Christian, yet she was of Jewish-Italian heritage. She was the mistress to an aristocratic patron, yet dogged by poverty and what she called her hard fortune throughout a long and eventful life. She was the first professional woman writer to have her poetry published in 17th century England. But her literary achievements were overshadowed by that Dark Lady tag. She was part of the Tudor and Stuart elite in a long life that ended age 76 in 1645 as the country was gripped by civil wars. Yet her writings challenged the religious and patriarchal assumptions of the time. Like so many of the other Tudors, her story poses the question, are they one of us or one of them? But as this series has kept asking, who is the we and who is them? Amelia Lanyer's story starts, like so many of the other Tudors, in London, in a church on the edge of the city's old walls, St. Botolph's without Bishopsgate, a church in which many Africans, Jews, Muslims and Indigenous Americans began, lived and ended their religious lives. And it's here in 1569 that Amelia Lanyer first enters the historical record. I visited the church with Professor Tracy Hill, an expert in Tudor London.
St. Botolph Bishopsgate is where Amelia Lanyer is baptised. Is there anything significant about that, about a woman of Jewish Italian heritage being baptised here?
Well, she would have been living in the... Her parents would have been living in the parish, so this area was associated with Dutch weavers, but it may have been amenable to aliens and strangers from other parts of the world, quite possibly. And her parentage is a little bit uncertain anyway, isn't it? But, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting fact that she's here on one of the St. Botolphs.
Amelia was baptised not as Lanyer, but Bassanio, the daughter of a Jewish Venetian emigre, the musician Battista Bassanio, who played for Queen Elizabeth. She grew up in a multicultural, polyglot world of music and courtiers. Clever, attractive, and enigmatic, she became the subject of an award-winning Globe Theatre production entitled Amelia, first performed in 2018. It was written by Morgan Lloyd Malcolm, who cast three black actors to play Amelia in acknowledgement of her Jewish and possibly African heritage. She told me about the challenges of writing about Amelia Lanyer.
Well, our starting point was the fact that there's nothing really written about her. We know that she attended court a couple of times, and we know that she was a mistress of Lord Hunsdon. That's pretty definite. If she's Jewish and she came from the Bassano region, we were talking to somebody who said, well, there's a possibility they'd be Sephardic Jew and therefore they might have come from North Africa. There's a route through there.
We also know that her parents died by the time she was 18. She was highly educated in the household of the Countess of Kent. In her 20s, her affair with Henry Carey, Baron Hunsdon, left her pregnant and led to an unhappy marriage with her cousin, another musician, Alfonso Lanyer. She had a son and subsequently a daughter who died. Much of what we know about her personal life comes from the astrologer Simon Forman, who Amelia Lanyer visited on several occasions. Forman was clearly attracted to her and used his consultations to talk about her sex life. Morgan Lloyd Malcolm realised Forman's account was highly questionable.
He wrote very disparagingly about her. You know, she's not having sex with him, so he's annoyed about that.
The character of Amelia in Lloyd Malcolm's play speaks back.
For centuries, these are the words they have used to describe me. Not anymore. I am Emilia.
In 1611, Emilia Lanier became the first woman to publish her own collection of poetry. It's called Salve Deus Rex Judaeorum, which is translated from the Latin as Hail God, King of the Jews. Despite all the talk about Emilia's sex life, the poems are about religion and virtue, and even reference her own Jewish heritage. One of the collection's dedications is also striking.
I have written this small volume or little book for the general use of all virtuous ladies and gentlewomen of this kingdom, and in commendation of some particular persons of our own sex.
For the first time in English, a woman uses a possessive adjective in dedicating her poetry to other women. And it's not the only first. Lanier's collection includes To Cookham, which is the first English country house poem. It describes an estate in Berkshire where she lived and wrote with her patron, Margaret Clifford, Countess of Cumberland. In it, Lanier looks back wistfully as the women leave the place where they read and wrote together.
And you, sweet Cookham, whom these ladies leave, I now must tell the grief you did conceive at their departure when they went away, how everything retained a sad dismay.
But the most powerful poem in Lanier's collection is Eve's Apology in Defence of Women. It offers a very different interpretation of the usual story of Adam and Eve's temptation that blames Eve for the fall and expulsion from Eden.
Our mother Eve, who tasted of the tree, giving to Adam what she held most dear, was simply good and had no power to see. But she, poor soul, by cunning was deceived. No hurt therein her harmless heart intended.
Eve was framed.
But surely Adam cannot be excused. Her fault, though great, yet he was most to blame.
Lanier isn't really writing religious poetry here. What she's actually doing is challenging the prevailing story of the time that underpinned gendered inequality. You can tell because she steps back from the biblical story and uses the possessive adjective again in addressing men.
You came not in the world without our pain. Make that a bar against your cruelty. Your fault being greater, why should you disdain our being your equals, free from tyranny?
You are the men, we are the women. Don't be tyrants. You should acknowledge us as equals. Lanier wants her voice as a woman to be distinct, but not other. Her challenge is over 400 years old, but it still resonates today. It remains the exception rather than the rule to see Lanier's poetry taught at university, where courses on Renaissance literature remain largely the preserve of male authors. And there was no happy ending for Emilia Lanier. Her husband died in 1613, and she tried to support herself by running a school for aristocratic children. But she got into debt, was arrested, and spent nearly three decades embroiled in financial and domestic disputes. She died in 1645, having never published again. As a woman of Jewish heritage, is Emilia Lanier an other Tudor? No, not really. As I've argued throughout this series, otherness is only a projection of a white, elite male historical tradition that's looked into the Tudor mirror and only seen itself reflected back. In retrieving these 10 individuals from the archive, I hope that we can start to see each one of them as just another Tudor, not the other Tudors. If we don't, we get a partial history that excludes so many communities, as the writer and broadcaster Fatima Manji argues.
Who is they and who are we? And which version of the national story are we talking about defending? Is it a one-dimensional one that is designed to protect the status quo? And is it one that whitewashes inconvenient truths?
For Fatima Manji, a more inclusive history of the Tudors fosters a sense of belonging among groups that came to be defined as English through forced or voluntary migration.
One of the frustrations for me is I thought I was so familiar with the Tudors. I mean, we are incessantly taught about Henry VIII and Elizabeth I in schools. Elizabeth I is sort of endlessly portrayed on stage and on screen, and yet I have never come across a depiction that shows her interactions with the Moroccan kingdom, with the Ottomans, etc. That was a huge frustration for me, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to share this history, because I think A, it's so important for people to know the reality, and for many people who feel connected to those parts of the world through language or culture or religion, to feel a sense of belonging in Britain. But also because, actually, it re-centres the reality of what was going on in England at the time when you think about Elizabethan England on the world stage.
Do you feel that you are hopeful of the way in which these histories are now being reconsidered, or what are your concerns about the future?
No, I think I am hopeful, and maybe I'm just a half-glass-full person, but I actually think that the very shouty so-called debate that we see play out in our newspapers, sometimes in broadcasting mediums too, and the statements that certain politicians make, aren't reflective of what the wider population feels about these issues. I think actually what would be great, and something I really want to see more of, is cultural depictions around some of these stories, around some of this hidden heritage.
It's a question of politics, education and history, including the Tudors. And it's about who gets to teach, research and write about that history to produce a more complex picture of the nation's heritage.
The conversation we have around heritage seems to be focused around either defending our history or tearing down statues. Actually, I think there's a lot to be said in between. So I want that conversation to be led by people from different backgrounds who are simply asking questions about our history.
Just a generation ago, the historical archives were primarily the domain of white male historians. As more women entered the archive, they began to tell a new story about gender and history. And now, as growing numbers of black British and Muslim scholars enter the archives, they'll also see our shared history in a new light. Like Fatima Manji, the historian David Olusoga is hopeful about what might be revealed.
This idea that we sometimes convince ourselves of, that the archives have yielded up all of their secrets, that our generations of historians have done it all and there's nothing for new historians, new generations to do, that's been dramatically and powerfully and really poignantly proved to be wrong. Who knows what's in the archives? Who knows what we might discover? That excites me. But I'm just as excited by a very kind of mundane idea, which is that this will just become a normal part of British history. Just that these are people living quite normal lives. It's a normal part of British history. It shouldn't be political. It shouldn't be toxic. The people writing about it shouldn't be the targets of politicised attacks. And I feel really confident that that will stop, because the younger people I encounter, the younger people I teach, just see it as part of British history.
As the Sri Lankan writer and activist Ambalavana Sivanandam once put it when speaking of England's migrant colonial communities, we are here because you were there. That story of England's multicultural history really began with the Tudors and the people whose voices you and I have been listening to throughout this series. In the end, they're not others. They're just Tudors.
I am Mohammed Al Nouri, Royal Ambassador.
I am Mary Phyllis, Morocco.
My name is Dr. Rodrigo Lopez.
They call me Aura Sultana.
My name is Chinano Dottore.